You're listening to SBS News.
The golden age of America begins right now.
Reciprocal, that means they do it to us and we do it to them.
Thing called Doge.
That's very big. It's the big, beautiful bill.
We're in charge.
You just keep going on the Epstein files.
You're gambling with World War III.
And I've been called much worse than a despot.
My proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker.
Yeah, well, we blew it up. It's blown up.
What I'd like to see, Canada become our 51st state.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip.
We need Greenland for national security.
I love stopping wars.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Welcome to World News Weekly and to the end of Donald Trump's first year back in the White House. Those were just a few of the more memorable moments, shall I put it that way. I'm Katrina Stewart in Sydney, back with international correspondent Claudia Farhart in Jakarta. Claudia, favourite Trump moment from the past year?
Oh, Kat, how could I possibly just pick one? It's a tough one. But if I had to choose, I'd probably say when he signed an executive order to end the war on water pressure and make showers great again. I guess no problem is too small for the US president.
I nearly forgot about that one. There really are too many. I think my most memorable moment would have to be Trump just casually downplaying the leaked texts between US officials about their war plans in Yemen.
That's a good one.
Yeah, a big yikes moment there. And speaking of memorable events, we'll have more on Trump's plans for Greenland and Europe's pushback, plus a big victory for the Syrian government as they announce an integration of the Kurdish forces into the national army.
Also this week, Donald Trump's Board of Peace. Who does it involve, and is it threatening to become a rival Security Council?
Would you like me to say a few words of Greenland? I was going to leave it out of the speech, but I think I would have been reviewed very negatively. Probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that. Okay? Now everyone's saying, oh, good. That's probably the biggest statement I made, because people thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force.
US President Donald Trump has dropped his threats to use force to acquire Greenland and later dropped his threat of tariffs as well. In a speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, he said he had reached an agreement with the NATO Secretary General for a future framework deal for Greenland, the details of which are still unknown.
Yeah, it certainly feels like a pretty big shift in rhetoric, Kat. I mean, especially off the back of the very awkward text exchange we saw between President Trump and the leaders of Norway and Finland earlier this week, when he was responding to Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre and Finnish President Alexander Stubb. He blamed Norway for failing to essentially just give him the Nobel Peace Prize, using that as some sort of partial justification for these plans to control Greenland.
Yeah, that's right. But it's clear the conversation is far from over. Trump is still calling for immediate negotiations and again asserting the US should acquire Greenland, insisting he wants, quote, right, title and ownership of the territory. It's been called the biggest transatlantic crisis since the Second World War. And while concerns over the future of NATO may be allayed for now, his speech certainly didn't put people's minds entirely at rest.
Yeah, it was a combative hour-long speech. He derided Europe. He mocked European allies, long-term allies. He mocked windmills. He criticised NATO. And he claimed he was the sole guarantor of global order. Among the many, many false claims he made in that speech, he said the US owned Greenland until after World War II, although he also, Kat, referred to it as Iceland four times, so yep. Who knows?
Yeah, that was a hard one to miss. Joining us now is Stefan Fruhling, professor at ANU's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre. Thanks so much for joining us, Stefan.
Thanks for having me.
This is a clear U-turn from Trump. Has Europe won, and does this mean NATO is no longer under threat?
Look, I think it is clear that Trump seems to have backed down from his earlier threats. We are not sure whether he's backed down from the ambition to gain sovereignty over Greenland, but certainly he has now revoked his threat of military action and also his threat to impose tariffs on European countries who supported Denmark. So in that sense, I think it's fair to say that Trump has backed down for the moment. How long that will last is a very different question. However, despite that this back down, I do think that this episode has left lasting damage to the NATO alliance, insofar as the fact that Trump seems to have been seriously considering, at least, and was certainly threatening the use of military force in order to take over and essentially conquer the territory of a NATO ally, is not something that Europeans can easily forget and walk away from. The fact that Europe this time was willing to threaten economic retaliation, which it was not willing to do yet in the context of the tariffs that Trump announced last year, demonstrates that Europe is now seeing its relationship with the United States in a very different light to even in the early parts of the second Trump administration.
Yeah, and there's obviously talk of this deal that Trump says he's worked on alongside NATO, and he did reveal a couple key aspects of this speaking to US news channel CNBC, including that US and European countries would collaborate on the Golden Dome missile system he's long heralded. Isn't that only kind of to protect the US, or is it perhaps a financial contribution that he's looking for here?
Look, it's very hard to say what he's looking for. I mean, notably, this backdown seems to have come after he spoke with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Of course, Rutte is not in any position to make commitments about, you know, Danish policy with regards to Greenland. But there is a longstanding agreement from dating back to 1952 that between Denmark and the United States that gives the U.S. Rights to operate and place military installations in Greenland for the purposes of NATO and North American defense. And so in many ways, what this looks like is simply a restatement of, you know, American position and the arrangements between America, NATO and Denmark with regards to Greenland that have existed for close on seven decades. Now, it'll be for the future to see what this means in practice, whether we're going to see an increase in American military engagement in Greenland. There's no indication that Denmark actually would have a problem with that. But insofar as the whole kind of crisis was about American attempts to gain political sovereignty over Denmark, that's a very different conversation from the one that we seem to be having now.
Yeah, and there has been plenty of domestic opposition to Trump's plans for Greenland, even within his own Republican ranks. There was also a sharp drop in stocks in the US responding to threats of a US-Europe trade war. Do you think these domestic concerns partially influenced his change of mind?
It's very hard to know, but what is notable is that there seems to have, as you mentioned, there seems to have been movements in the American stock market, in particular movements in the American bond market. And noting that Europe is actually the largest holder of American treasury bonds, and the Americans are running a very significant deficit, have very significant need to refinance their loans. Any move, and we saw some very tentative moves and hints from Europe that it might reduce purchases of American bonds, I think that that would probably have weighed pretty heavily on him, because his back down on the tariffs last year also was preceded by some jitters in the bond market.
Yeah, and you know, is this really just Trump's art of the deal? We're seeing him defuse a crisis of his own making. And was Europe right to abandon their efforts to win him with flattery and call his bluff?
Look, I think that yes, this is him backing down and selling that as a victory. I think that's pretty clear. I do think that it has vindicated Europe not, giving in or pretending to enter into sham negotiations, but actually, you know, threatening to push back. How Europeans and the U.S. will take this forward, insofar as the actual defense of Greenland is concerned, we will have to see. Certainly, Europeans have indicated that they're very willing to deploy more forces to address these American concerns about the defense of Greenland, which in themselves are actually, you know, somewhat shambolic. But I think that, you know, whatever practical cooperation will come out of this will not undo the political damage and the loss of confidence in the way that the U.S. has behaved towards its allies in the recent weeks.
So Donald Trump is backing down from these military threats, but he's still making it very clear he wants to own and control Greenland. He's arguing this is all about national security, that, you know, China or Russia would take it if he doesn't. Does that argument in any way stack up, or is this about something else? Is this about his legacy?
It's very hard to see how Russia or China would pose a threat to the sovereignty of Greenland or be able to take over Greenland. I mean, Russia certainly has the ability to deploy force and naval and air force into that area, but that's very much short of, you know, a threat to the taking over Greenland. China has increased interest and engagement in the Arctic, but that tends to be more up on, you know, in Alaska and linked to the opening of sea lines there, less on the Greenland side, and certainly not a direct military threat.
So in that sense, these arguments about the US needing control of Greenland in order to defend it are quite spurious. And I think the reasons are much more imperialistic, as you mentioned, and probably that Trump has, I would assume, some kind of idea that he could well enter, or he might want to enter into the history books as the first American president in many, many decades who has once more extended American territory.
Well, this is clearly a rapidly evolving story, so I think the whole world will be watching anxiously to see how this unfolds. Thanks so much for joining us today, Stefan.
Thank you.
After almost 2 weeks of heavy clashes in Syria's northeast, the interim government in Damascus and the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces signed a ceasefire deal, set to finally see the SDF integrated into the National Army. As part of the deal, the SDF also agreed to withdraw from two provinces that came under its control when it fought the IS terror group alongside US forces during Syria's civil war, and relinquish control of Al-Hasaka province, its main stronghold. But within hours of it being announced, there were already reports of fresh fighting in the area. We'll get to those new clashes in a moment, Claudia, but let's start with the significance of this deal. The interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, has been struggling to get the SDF to integrate pretty much since he toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime in December 2024. If it does end up holding, what's this deal going to mean for his government and for the country?
This is going to be huge for al-Sharaa. This is really the first time since the Arab Spring began that the Syrian government now controls almost all of Syria. Sharaa got most of the rebel groups and factions to agree to integrate into the army in the early days after he toppled Assad back in late 2024. But the SDF talks have been stalled for almost 12 months now. Damascus had set this de facto deadline of the end of last year, though. The SDF sort of contested whether that was legit or not. In any case, the deadline passed, and then what we saw was this massive ramping up of this offensive, this government offensive into the northeast. It was almost like, if you're not going to agree to integrate at the negotiating table, we will force you to integrate by force. The SDF commander in the end said that he had no choice but to accept the deal that was proposed just to stop the killing. So it's a huge win for Ahmed al-Sharaa, but it is a major blow for the Kurds in Syria. They did get some symbolic gestures in this deal. There was a presidential decree that declared them to be an integral and original component of the country. Stateless Kurds can now get Syrian nationality. They've recognized Kurdish as a national language, which will mean that it can be taught in schools in Kurdish-majority areas. So there are some cultural gains there. But the Kurds had de facto autonomy in these parts of northeastern Syria for more than a decade. And now that overnight has been taken away from them. And this is only, I mean, we've got to remember, just a few months after the PKK was disbanded in Turkey as well. And it's been interesting this week to see, other than Ahmed al-Sharaa, perhaps nobody's been happier about this than the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, because he's always insisted that the SDF is an extension of the PKK. The big question now, I think, Kat, other than the obvious one of whether this deal will hold, given the clashes we've seen since it was announced, is will al-Shara and his interim government make a big push for the rest of the country now? The other final major pocket that's still out of their control are these areas controlled by Druze factions in the south. That could be a little bit more complicated to resolve, though. Those factions do have Israeli support. There were reports after the toppling of the Assad regime in Israeli media, actually, that the Israeli government had been funneling weapons and reinforcements to those factions to sort of bolster them in the country's south. And the government's past attempts to retake that area have been met with Israeli airstrikes. So that one could be more complicated, but al-Shara will no doubt be very happy at this stage to have most of the country under his control.
Yeah, as you said, though, it's definitely off to a shaky start. Part of the deal signed on Sunday was meant to see the prisons holding IS fighters handed over from the SDF to the government, as well as the camps where their families are being detained. But on Monday, clashes erupted around two of these prisons, both sides blaming the other for starting it. And in the chaos, a large number of these detained IS fighters escaped. We're getting varying numbers. The SDF originally said 1,500 fighters had broken out. The Syrian government puts it closer to 120. Damascus says it's now taking control of the prisons and recaptured most of those who escaped. But it's raised all sorts of security concerns, Claudia.
Yeah, huge security concerns, Kat. I mean, this handover of the IS prisons and the camps looked like one of the riskiest parts of this deal from the start. Just before the fall of Bashar al-Assad, the US estimated that there were still 2,500 active IS fighters across Syria and Iraq. But we know that since then, they've been getting even more active. There was a report commissioned for the UN Security Council about halfway through last year that found that evidence that they were seeking to exploit all of the volatility and instability that had come with this transition period for Syria. And in the months after that, we saw several deadly attacks and also that series more recently of US airstrikes sort of in response to them. The interesting part is what's going to happen in the future with these camps, with these prisons, and with the broader coalition against IS, because the US is now saying it's going to be dealing directly with Damascus on all issues relating to IS, not with the SDF, which were, you know, which for more than a decade now have been their longtime partners in this. The SDF is hugely experienced in managing these camps, in managing these prisons. Al-Shara and his interim government just simply are not. And al-Shara himself is a former jihadist. So, I mean, that raises some questions as well. So the idea that these prisons and these camps can just be handed over rapidly in 24 hours at a time where the risk of an IS resurgence is as high as it's been really in the last few years is sort of a hard sell for the region.
President Macron saying he will not join the Board of
Peace. Oh, did he say that? Well, yeah. Nobody wants him because he's going to be out of office very soon. So, you know, that's all right. What I'll do is if they feel like Costco, I'll put a 200% tariff on his wines and champagnes, and he'll join.
You invited President Putin to be a member of the Board of Peace?
Yeah, he's been invited.
The US president there on who may and may not end up on his Board of Peace, which he will, of course, be chairing for life. Over the weekend, letters went out to at least 60 countries offering them a permanent spot on the board for the cool price of $1 billion. Donald Trump's confident it'll be worth their while, though, calling it, quote, the greatest and most prestigious board ever assembled. This was originally meant to be the group set up to oversee the US's 20-point peace plan for the Gaza Strip. It now seems to have turned into something very different, Claudia.
Yeah, very different indeed, Kat. We've now seen the very lengthy charter that was sent out to the countries who received their invitations over the weekend. In it, there is no mention of the Gaza Strip, no mention of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, no mention of a two-state solution. Instead, it says that this board would secure enduring peace in areas affected or threatened by conflict. So immediately clear that Donald Trump has cooked up a mandate well beyond the Gaza Strip here. And it also calls for, quote, a more nimble and effective international peace-building body, Well, the world already has a peace-building body. It's called the UN Security Council, and this reads a lot like a rival of that. Donald Trump's dislike for the United Nations is very well documented. I mean, we were speaking about our favourite Trump moments from the past year earlier. How could we forget his speech at the UN General Assembly, where he said the only thing the UN had given him was a broken escalator? But, you know, even at the start of this year, he withdrew the US from another two dozen UN groups. So I guess the question people are asking now, we were talking about NATO in regards to Greenland. He's trying to, it seems, undermine NATO. Is he here trying to undermine the UN? Unlike the UN, though, this board would answer directly to Donald Trump. He appoints the members. He has the final say. It's also unclear what authority, if any, he has to do this. I mean, the UN Security Council did approve a mandate for this Board of Peace idea back in November, but it was only approved to work in relation to the Gaza Strip, and it was only approved to work through to the end of 2027. Its real goal was to deploy an international peacekeeping force to the Gaza Strip, and originally the timeline that they were working towards was the end of January. Well, we're now here, and there's still no sign of them. Instead, we have this very ambitious plan to set up a board that makes no real reference to Gaza.
Yeah, it's really thrown a spanner in the works for the UN and created kind of an awkward scene. The Secretary General's spokesperson said member states are free to associate with different groups as they please. But as we heard in that exchange earlier with Donald Trump on the tarmac, there seems to be a lot of reluctance from the world leaders who have received invites to get involved with this. That's unsurprising, I guess, as it sounds a bit like he's angling to be king of the world. What are the sorts of calculations they're doing here?
Well, I mean, publicly, many of them so far have responded sort of in the way that Anthony Albanese did, saying, you know, thanks so much for the invite, such a great honour. We'll review it and we'll get back to you. Because I think by this point, you know, a year into the second term, most of them have now learned that nothing good comes from insulting the man, as we just heard with Emmanuel Macron and the threat of 200% tariffs. I mean, they're going to have a huge list of concerns when it comes to this, not least of which will be the other countries who've been invited. Yes, there are some like-minded nations on that list of 60 that got the invites. You know, Canada's there, the UK, many European nations, but there's also Belarus, there's also Russia. So a lot of these nations are going to be asking themselves, what are the implications of joining a body with the word peace in the name alongside someone like Vladimir Putin, who's wanted by the ICC? But will they be coerced into joining? Because it certainly sounds like he wants to coerce Emmanuel Macron into joining. And for those countries that do want to become permanent members, you know, if any decide to take that route, and it's not clear if they will, well, what are they going to do with the $1 billion US dollars that they have to pay up? I mean, does Donald Trump decide what happens with that? He's chair for life. He's only president, though, for three more years. A lot of these countries are sort of, you know, hoping to just ride out that time and return to some sort of semblance of international normality after that, but not under this model, Kat.
Yeah, and at the same time that these invites were going out, Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff also declared we've now reached phase two of the Gaza ceasefire deal, which he says is going to focus on reconstruction, demilitarization, and technocratic governance of the Strip. So as part of that, they've formed a bunch of other groups that will report to Donald Trump's Board of Peace, the main one being the Gaza Executive Board. And that's made up of Trump insiders like Witkoff and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. There's also former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair and officials from Qatar and Turkey, which has really annoyed Israel. But it's also drawn criticism for not involving a single Palestinian. So I guess how likely is it that this group is actually going to be able to get any of these phase two ambitions done?
If you look at what's meant to happen in phase two, it seems next to impossible. I mean, reconstruction, for example. How can you reconstruct the Gaza Strip when Israeli airstrikes are continuing? I mean, since the ceasefire came into effect, the local authorities there have reported more than 450 deaths. The board is meant to be pulling in foreign investment for this rebuild. It's estimated that it will cost something like $100 billion to do that. Who's going to fork up that money while these strikes are continuing? And in terms of how long the strikes are going to continue, well, if you look at the model in Lebanon, where we've now had a ceasefire in effect for something like 14 months, they still haven't stopped. So it's not great cause for hope. On demilitarization, I mean, no one has really, in the region or beyond, stepped up just yet to say, yes, we're happy to be involved with this. It's hugely awkward for the Arab nations to have to get involved with disarming Hamas. Plans for the peacekeeping force, the peace enforcement force that was originally meant to do that, have largely gone cold. I mean, one of the most enthusiastic countries in that was here in Indonesia. There were some talks towards the end of last year that they were preparing troops for that training potentially. There's been no mention of that ever since. And Israel wanted to veto most of the countries that sort of indicated they'd be happy to participate anyway, most of the Middle Eastern Muslim nations who had indicated they might put their hands up. Israeli forces still occupy at least half of the strip. There's no timeline for their withdrawal. So if we're talking about demilitarization, there's not a lot of cause for hope there either. On the issue of governance, they have also set up a 15-member technocratic committee. It's going to be headed by a man called Ali Shaath. He's from Gaza, but he used to be an official on the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. This technocratic committee has no real power, though, Kat. I mean, Hamas and Israel on the ground still control the actual territory. And this committee is just going to answer to Donald Trump's board anyway. So Palestinians are concerned that the people on it, I mean, if you look at the lineup, you mentioned some of them, like his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, his envoy, Steve Witkoff. The worry is those types of people are only going to back Israel's goals when it comes down to it anyway. So looking at phase two, no, there's not a lot of hope coming from anyone that it's going to be successful.
Okay, it's that time of the episode where we take our collection of passports, in my case, to Claudia, and do a quick whip around the world to touch on some other news happening this week. Iran's national police chief has issued an ultimatum to protesters, saying they must hand themselves in within 3 days or face the full force of the law. General Ahmad Reza Radan assuring leniency to those who do. Tens of thousands of protesters have already been apprehended in a nationwide manhunt as regime forces patrol the streets, threatening to shoot anyone who comes outside.
This all started last month in Tehran's Grand Bazaar over economic grievances. It quickly turned political and spread nationwide. But after 4 weeks, they've been all but snuffed out. The internet remains fully blocked for most people across Iran, despite a very brief period of partial reconnection we saw on Sunday. The regime is also warning Donald Trump not to take any action against the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, days after the US president called for an end to his nearly 40-year reign.
And less than 3 months since she took the top job, Japanese Prime Minister Sane Takaichi has announced plans to trigger a snap election. The campaign will be short and sharp, with the vote scheduled for less than 3 weeks from now on the 8th of February. Ms. Takaichi has been riding high in the polls with an approval rating of 78%, which she's hoping will translate into her Liberal Democratic Party winning back its lower house majority.
Yeah, in her short time as Prime Minister so far, she's been talking tough on immigration and refusing to back down from this growing feud with China. And all of that's resonated quite well with conservatives and nationalists in the country. So she's feeling pretty confident heading into this. But there are also huge risks for her there. A lot of voters still name cost of living as their number one concern in Japan. And they feel that that's now gone on the back burner to some of these other issues. And Japan's two biggest opposition parties have just formed a new centrist alliance, and they will be trying to sway longtime LDP voters who fear that Ms. Takaichi is now taking the party too far to the right.
Vietnamese Communist Party officials are gathering in Hanoi this week for their highly secretive National Congress. These talks only happen once every 5 years, and they're when the party will decide its leaders and policies all the way through to 2031. The public won't hear much about what actually goes on inside, but in the lead up to this year's Congress, there was plenty of speculation, Claudia.
Yeah, Kat, current party chief To Lam is expected to hold on to his position. But on top of that, he now wants to combine the party leadership with the presidency, which would give him really unprecedented power. Analysts say he's already acted as the de facto head of state since he took over about 18 months ago. He's been on almost 24 state visits overseas. That's usually something that's performed by the president anyway. But there are signs that the military is pushing back against these ambitions he has. So nothing is certain just yet.
The fallout from Uganda's contentious presidential election continues, with the country's military chief saying He was praying for fugitive opposition leader Bobi Wine's death and gave him 48 hours to surrender to the police. The former pop star turned politician said he fled a military raid on his house hours before 81-year-old President Yoweri Museveni was declared the landslide winner of last week's vote. It will be his seventh term in power.
Wine, who finished runner-up, has alleged widespread fraud during the vote, releasing several statements from undisclosed locations.
Claudia, I thought we could do with a little uplifting human story this week.
We always can, Kat.
Well, I don't want to get your hopes up. You know, it's a story that does start with slaughtering pigs. I want to apologise in advance to all our vegetarian listeners.
Oh, any story that starts with an apology, I'm not sure how well this is going to go, Kat.
Look, bear with me. It does get a little bit brighter. A young Chinese woman sent out a plea for help on Douyin, their version of TikTok, because she was worried her ageing dad would struggle to process, butcher, I don't know the right terminology to use here, but essentially, yeah, butcher their pigs this year. And it's virtually a social ritual in many parts of rural China that occurs ahead of Chinese New Year. Dai Dai in her 20s promised they would get a pork banquet after.
Okay, I see where this is going because, you know, who can resist a free meal?
Yeah, so that's essentially what happened. She thought, you know, I might get a few people to come over and help, but over a million people reacted to her message and thousands turned up, so many from all over the country. There were so many that there were traffic jams getting to the village. And way more than she could feed. So the local government laid on food and it basically turned into an impromptu banquet that, get this, lasted 2 days.
Oh, no way.
There was even a live stream which got 20 million likes. So it just shows people all over the world are after a bit of human connection.
Yeah, human connection, Kat, or maybe just after a bit of crispy pork, I don't know. But
I'm trying to
either
put
way,
a positive spin on this and see the best in people. Give me a chance.
Crispy pork can be the best in some of us sometimes.
That's true. I did have bacon in my lunch today. I do need to confess that to our listeners.
It all checks out.
And that is The World This Week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. We'll have a new episode for you every Thursday.
Who knows? We might even have a pork banquet for you as well. come back to find out. Thank you, as always, to the wonderful producers behind World News Weekly. They are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers, and Billy Dallenberg. And thanks to you, Kat. See you next week.
See you then, Claudia.